And now for the last talk of the session, we have Darius Torchinsky and Christoph Kleber from the Nelson Group, Structural Correlation Length and Timescales of Complex Materials.
So hello to this last talk of today. You will hear about two different spectroscopic techniques. First from me, and in the second part from Darius. But first, before I start with the talk, I want to motivate why one does acoustic spectroscopy. When an acoustic wave travels through a medium with a certain velocity, it interacts with density fluctuations of the medium. And these density fluctuations can be both static and dynamic in nature. So then the inverse of the acoustic frequency now is on the order of a characteristic relaxation time. Or if the inverse of the acoustic wave vector is of the size of a structural element, then the acoustic wave that travels through the medium changes its sound velocity, and the acoustic attenuation happens through this, and this is detectable, and the experimentalist can then conclude about static and dynamic features of the sample. We use this technique now to study disordered materials, gases and liquids. I will first give you a survey of different acoustic techniques so that you have a picture of what different techniques cover, what frequency range. And then in the first part, I'll talk about one technique, the picosecond ultrasonic technique, and we studied silica glass with that. And in the second part, Darius will use another technique, impulsive stimulated thermal scattering on a supercooled liquid. Okay, so let's start at the low frequency range. There are piezoelectric techniques that can measure bulk modulus and shear modulus, and this is followed by ultrasonic methods that can measure both the shear and the longitudinal sound velocity and acoustic attenuation. Then here in the megahertz range, impulsive stimulated scattering techniques work, and depending on the setup, one can measure shear and longitudinal attenuation and sound velocity. And in this range around 1 GHz, Brillouin light scattering techniques optically measure thermally excited acoustic waves traveling through a medium. The gigahertz range is the technique that I will talk about in a second. It's called picosecond ultrasonics, and in the far, in the really high range, there are X-ray and neutron scattering. So these are the two techniques you hear about. Okay, so why do we study glasses now? So glasses have thermal properties that are unusual compared to their crystalline counterpart. So this plot on the right side shows the thermal conductivity of SiO2 as a function of temperature. And this higher plot here is the crystalline form, it's quartz, and the lower plot is the amorphous form, it's vitreous silica. The crystalline form nicely shows the Debye behavior, the T to the temperature to the power of 3 function or whatever of the thermal conductivity. But this is not true for the silica glass, which is many orders of magnitude lower and has this plateau at around 10 Kelvin. Okay, so how can we understand this? In order to understand this macroscopic feature of the thermal conductivity, it's best to look at the microscopic structure of the material, and that's best to do by looking at this famous formula, which is valid. It's known to known that the thermal properties of insulators are are dominated by acoustic transport. And so we look at, we connect with this formula, the macroscopic feature here, the thermal conductivity, with the acoustic mean free path L. And an estimate of this acoustic mean free path in the important region to understand this part of the temperature range here is shown here in this part. It's the gigahertz range, and you see different regions here. The important region that we're interested in is this one, and especially this crossover, and different mechanisms are responsible for the heat transport, and it's still hotly debated which mechanism is responsible for what. It was often assumed that this region B is Rayleigh scattering, but new calculations show that this seems to be at least one order of magnitude too low, and there are several candidates for this region, like thermally activated relaxation processes or two-level system interactions, but it's not clear what is the real interaction that takes place here. And to get a better picture of that, it's important to have a good idea how this curve looks like, and especially where this crossover takes place. And to do so, we have developed a technique which, yeah, I can't talk much about, so just that much. And we have a pump probe set up, which consists of a pulse shaper, which is called the Death Star, which is shown here. And we detect the acoustic waves on the other side of the sample with an interferometric setup. Here is an example for a very simple sample, a substrate and a metal film deposited on it. We shoot a series of several pulses onto this metal film. The metal film heats up and expands and launches an acoustic wave through it. And the interferometer then detects the displacement, which is the step structure, and with analysis of this, one can get the frequency spectrum of it, and depending on the set frequency of this pulse shaper, one gets the peak, which is here, centered around 40 gigahertz. So, now, one can use this simple structure and deposit the sample film on it, which is in our case the glass, and then another receiver film on the back side of the film. Then this acoustic wave gets generated and travels through the glass to the back side, experience attenuation through this, gets reflected on the back side, travels back, and makes a round trip and gets detected again. This black line is the timeline, and if you unfold this timeline, then you get here the time plot of this here. The x-axis is the time, and the red is the displacement that we measure, and the calculated strain in blue. And we have these three different sample thicknesses here, and what you see here is the following. At T0, the excitation process happens, then depending on the sample thickness here, here, and here, the acoustic signal arrives at the back, and after another round trip, the echo arrives. You can also clearly see that there's strong attenuation of the acoustic wave traveling through by comparing the modulation, high frequency modulation, and you can also quantitatively do this, qualitatively do this by looking at the spectral amplitude of it, and then you can, by comparing the intensity of this first signal, which is the high peak here, compared to the echo, you can calculate the attenuation. So I want to conclude my part of the talk with showing you the data that we got for several frequencies. The data here are shown in brown and are compared with other techniques and other data that are out there. There's only one other measurement out there in the same frequency range, which is done with a very similar technique that we do. And there's a strong, measured attenuation seems to be much weaker, and this seems to be really showing that Rayleigh scattering in this high frequency range is not a good candidate for describing this. So I guess so much for me, and now
there is.
So, Christoph just gave you a little bit of an insight on ways that we have of monitoring relaxation and materials that are both governed by length scale and by time scale, or rather that he can examine them both in terms of length scale and time scale by looking at mean free paths and picking particular frequencies to look at materials with the Death Star. And I'm going to talk about this glass forming class of materials, and in particular, even though they are random, their relaxation spectrum actually has a lot of structure. There are two, generally speaking, there are two relaxation peaks. There's the alpha relaxation and the beta relaxation. The alpha relaxation is given by all of these collective degrees of freedom, you know, the ones that are responsible for flow in particular. And these are very, very sensitive to temperature. And in fact, the reason why your material gets glassy and why your maple syrup doesn't pour as easily when you pull it out of the fridge in the morning is that all of these modes that are responsible for relaxation get pushed out to lower lower frequencies as the temperature goes down. And there's also this higher frequency group of relaxation modes called the beta relaxation, which is accessible in the around the 10 gigahertz to 1 terahertz regime, and that's more along the lines of what Christoph's device is able to characterize. So I'm mainly going to speak about what goes on down here. And in our experiments that I've done on this material, which is called tetramethyl tetraphenyl trisiloxane, here's a picture of it, it's just called BC704, silicon pump oil. I just take an excitation beam, I split it into two, and I image these two beams onto a sample. This excitation beam, when I cross them as two in the sample, that generates an interference pattern. The interference pattern deposits heat, also in a sinusoidal pattern in the material. That impulsive heating generates a sound wave, and the sound waves propagate away from the region of excitation, and I monitor them with a probe beam. So what the signal looks like, and here I show the signal on the liquid phase of the material at 300 Kelvin, is you just see oscillations at a particular frequency. And another thing to notice is that this time scale shows hundreds of nanoseconds. Now I cool the liquid down a little bit, and as I showed you back up here, these relaxation peaks tend to shift to lower frequencies as I decrease the temperature. And what happens is that as I hit a temperature where the material becomes viscous, all of a sudden these relaxation peaks, this alpha relaxation, find itself right on top of the frequency that I'm looking at with my sound waves. And a lot of the acoustic energy is redistributed into the relaxation mechanism of the glass forming liquid. I then keep on cooling down even further, and then all of a sudden all of these relaxation peaks alpha relaxation has passed out of the region of examination, and now for all intents and purposes I have a glass and I'm looking at a solid. Another thing to notice is that the frequency here is appreciably higher than it is over here in the liquid phase, even though these are four acoustic waves of the same wavelength of 40 microns. So this plot here shows the whole temperature evolution of studying both the frequency and the damping rate of this glass-forming liquid at an acoustic wavelength of 40 microns. Now bear in mind, I should have mentioned this, but our measurement technique can access frequencies from about 1 megahertz to a gigahertz, or in terms of wavelengths, we're talking about 100 microns down to the single micron regime. And so what we see is that as the temperature gets decreased, you see the frequency go up. This is an indication that the material is going from being a liquid, which is pretty pliable, of course, to being a solid glass. It becomes more stiff. As we also pass through this region where the alpha relaxation lies on top of the frequencies that we're looking at, we see that damping undergoes a very sharp increase here to a peak at about 255 Kelvin, where we're sitting right on top of the maximum of the alpha relaxation peak, and then the alpha relaxation peak passes out of the regime of interest again and the damping goes back down. So in order to get a full characterization of what's going on, in principle, what we would do is we would change this lambda, we would look at a different acoustic wavelength that corresponds to a different acoustic frequency. This would then cause this peak here to shift to a different temperature, because the frequency that we're looking at is slightly different. So the point at which it becomes coincident with the alpha relaxation will also change. And so then, by combining a bunch of different measurements of this sort, we can determine the full temperature-dependent relaxation spectrum. Now, we've made this grating in the material, and it's generated an acoustic wave for us, and it's done this for us by heating. But the heat still kind of remains around, and in fact, the question is, well, what happens to what we've done, you know, after what we've initially been interested is over? And it turns out that we can get a lot more information out of this measurement too. So we look out at longer times and we see that the heat just decays along, you know, just by normal thermal diffusion. And in fact, we can look again here at the regime of the strong acoustic damping, and yes, the heat is still dissipating. So we see that we're looking on at information that's on the range of hundreds of nanoseconds to hundreds of microseconds, and we need to be able to look at this all on the same kind of plot. So what's much easier for us to do is to put everything on a log time plot here, which is what I've done on the bottom. And so the question remains, okay, now I've done all of this, what am I going to learn? Well, let's now look at the transition step by step. We start off with a liquid, 300 Kelvin, fast acoustic oscillations, then we have a long time, and then the thermal diffusion kicks in and is over. Then we, you know, cool things down a little bit, and as I showed you before, this alpha relaxation peak lies right on the frequency that we're examining. The acoustic attenuation becomes very large. The acoustic wave is completely gone, much earlier than it was before, because all of its energy has been traded away to structural rearrangement. And then, you know, we wait a while and the heat dissipates. But then, you know, we cool things down even more. And all of a sudden we notice that if I were to look at the acoustic piece of this material here, this thing looks like a solid. This frequency is closer to the frequency of the glassy phase than it is the liquid phase. But I also noticed that the signal has this sort of little increase in it too. And what's really happening is that you've now gotten so highly viscous that this heating that I use to generate my acoustic wave, it isn't able to actually immediately cause thermal expansion to happen. The thermal expansion is belabored, in fact. And we monitor this over the course of several microseconds, tens of microseconds, in fact. And at the same time, the heat that has caused the excitation is also decaying away, and we monitor that too. And then finally, when we cool things down again, enough so that all of these alpha relaxation peak is completely gone, and in fact, it's the alpha relaxation which is also responsible for this rise. After that is all done, we cool things down, we have just, again, the simple acoustic oscillation, not much happens, thermal decay. So I kind of want to take a better, closer look at what's going on here. And in fact, we have in the past been able to come up with models that very, very correctly describe all of the salient points of the data that we have. And so here I've shown the data at a particular temperature and the fit to that data. And the important thing to notice is that this piece of the fit, which is caused by this rise, in other words, the sort of inhibited thermal expansion that occurs, this is pretty appropriately fit to a stretched exponential, which is a very common thing in this community to be able to talk about alpha relaxation dynamics. In particular, there is a lot of meaning pinned to this parameter beta here, which in the case of this particular liquid, I should have written it down, is about 0.6. So this is a highly non-exponential complex relaxation that goes on that we're able to capture with a single measurement that's just initially looking at acoustics. And again, there's also the thermal decay, and we can fit that at the same time too. So, getting back to this picture before we wrap up, what I've shown you is that our ability to look at the alpha relaxation using ISTS and this impulsive stimulated thermal scattering, the mechanism by which we generate these acoustic waves in the megahertz regime. This allows us to examine how the evolution and the structure of this alpha peak looks like, of all of these relaxation modes associated with flow. We can study this with this technique. And then with the Death Star that Christoph has introduced you to, we're hoping to be able to get access to this beta relaxation peak here, which is too high frequency to be accessed with the ISTS measurement. The reason that this is really important is because, at least in terms of mechanical spectroscopy, and all of the theory is done in terms of mechanical degrees of freedom, this hasn't been done before. It's only been done for dielectric spectroscopy, and there are a lot of predictions that need to be tested, that have been tested with dielectric spectroscopy, but specifically need to be tested with mechanical spectroscopy, and we are in a unique position to be able to do all of that at one time. So, in principle, what we're really after is being able to test the fundamental theories and relationships between the parameters for the beta relaxation and the alpha relaxation. It turns out that they're actually intimately linked. And just by means of wrapping up about our future directions, we are planning on extending our analysis of the megahertz and gigahertz structure relaxations, in other words, the alpha and beta relaxation that I've talked about, through using more ISTS measurements on this liquid at different, you know, wave vectors and different temperatures, and using the Death Star to look at the beta peak. We're also planning to do shear acoustics on these materials, and here's an example of a shear wave that I got right before the vacation. And this measurement can produce shear waves for us in the regime of the single megahertz to hundreds of megahertz, and our own Thomas Pezzarel is working on extending this measurement into the gigahertz, the same sort of the Death Star version of shear wave measurements. We're also able to do high pressure studies, and we're looking to see how the role of pressure influences the glass transition by tuning the density of the liquid, not just its temperature. And I'd like to thank Professor Keith Nelson for his unflagging support in all of this studies. I'd like to thank Christoph Kleber for being a great lab mate and also a good collaborator on this project. And I'd also like to thank Tina Heckscher, who isn't present right now, who's back in Denmark, having a baby probably today, for her help with all of these measurements. I'd like to thank you for your attention.
I'm not sure, but I think the structure of glass is partly dependent on the temperature history, that if you...
Yes, this is true.
Is that something of interest to your project?
Not in particular. We're looking at things... I turn the temperature down pretty slowly for this experiment, so I'm not sure how reproducible we could really make it. We are involved in an experiment where we do, with collaborators in Washington State, where they increase the pressure effectively instantaneously by ramming a projectile at it at a few hundred meters per second. So in essence, we can kind of access this quasi-static and also opposite of that limit with that kind of experiment, but temperature, it's not so easy to do that. Like, we really, the thing is that in a lot of these measurements, we really want to know the temperature very accurately. And so, you know, we have like the temperature meter is immersed in the liquid and everything, and you know, plunging the thing in liquid nitrogen is kind of a little too chaotic for me to be able to do that. So that's kind of beyond the scope of what I could do.
How much do you heat the sample during the ISTS process, and does it affect the alpha?
The amount of heating is really a perturbative linear response experiment. I think that a number that I have heard tossed around is a tenth of a Kelvin in terms of the amount of temperature. Like, the amount of energy per pulse is about 100 microjoules in these experiments, so it's not that much. And the absorption is very, very weak, like third overtone absorption of 1 micron light into an OH stretch. So almost all of this 100 microjoules of light is going straight through the sample anyway. So I think it's pretty safe to assume that the temperature that we read in the liquid is not getting changed too much by the laser. Occasionally you make a mistake and you put too much light in there and things start boiling, and that's a problem, but that's because of other nonlinear things happening with the laser. But to answer your question, it's very, very linear response experiment.
Any more questions? No, let's thank all of the speakers. Oh,
where? I look at the temperature dependence of the damping factor before in the liquid in the glass. It kind of looks similar to, if I look at those slopes, before and after the big change.
Yeah.
And those are, you know, it's two different things. Is there any kind of feeling for my life? I was guessing it might be a lot different. So.
The thing is that I should have put, the problem is that there's a little bit of error on this fit. And, you know, but the way the measurement is done, you pump a region with a finite size beam and you probe it with a finite size beam. And as it was when I actually did the experiment, I noticed that there were finite size effects that were sort of inherent in that as well. I honestly can't, so this, that might cloud this picture a little bit, and it might not be able to, you know, give one an ability to make such a comment. I don't know. And to give you an honest answer, I really don't know much about if there's a physical meaning ascribed to how this should look. Obviously, this is representative of what the alpha relaxation peak looks like for the glass-forming liquid. And what I've seen of those, they tend to be asymmetric, so I would expect this to be asymmetric as well. But, you know, that maybe someone else could give you a more educated answer on.
Okay, well, let's thank these speakers and all the speakers. We should also thank the spectroscopy lab management for putting together a really wonderful day. And it's a special treat to be able to see such a wide range of spectroscopy presented so well. And Ramachandra, in particular, we thank you too. So, we're adjourned. Okay.